Other banks go out of their way to make redeeming credit card rewards needlessly complicated, like how they require minimums or force you to use your rewards before reaching some arbitrary expiration date. But Discover isn't like that. With Discover, you can redeem your rewards for cash in any amount, at any time, so you'll never have to jump through hoops. Unless you're like a trapezist, then by all means, go right ahead. Learn more at discover.com/redeem rewards. Terms apply.
Thank you for downloading Tucker Center Talks. This is Season 3, Episode 2. You're listening to Tucker Center Talks, a podcast from the Tucker Center for Research on Girls and Women in Sport at the University of Minnesota and a co-production with WISP Sports. I'm your host for Tucker Center Talks, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, Director of the Tucker Center. The Tucker Center is a first-of-its-kind, world-class research center and a thought leader that accelerates systems change for girls and women in sport. Tucker Center Talks is a place where I talk to, amplify, and support my female colleagues, amazing women who study sport and gender. We let the data tell the story, and we talk about research and ways in which we use data to create change in the world through the context of sport to be a better place. Speaking of making the world a better place, in this podcast, I am talking to Dr. Nefertiti Walker, Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, Chief Diversity Officer, and an Associate Professor of Sport Management at UMass Amherst. Her area of expertise is in sport organizational culture. Specifically, she studies intersectionality, typically of race, gender, and culture in sport. She is a NASM research fellow, has her own consulting firm, and is a very sought-after scholar on diversity, equity, inclusion, appearing recently as a panelist on the Female Quotients Equality Lounge at Davos, and was a panelist for our very own Tucker Center Fall Distinguished Lecture Series in 2020 called Black Women in Sport, Voices of Resistance and Athlete Activism, where she enlightened all of us about social justice and the WNBA using a lens of intersectionality. Whew! We have a lot to talk about, Dr. Walker. Welcome, friend, colleague, fellow Peloton groupie, Tucker Center affiliated scholar, and all around badass woman. Welcome, Dr. Walker.
Thank you. I'm so incredibly happy to be here.
Wow. So we have a lot to discuss. Your work is red hot right now, very relevant, very needed, and you are being called upon probably more than I even realized. So thank you for taking your time to talk on Tucker Center Talks today. Just why don't you broadly just tell us about your research, because we like to talk about research on this as it relates to gender and or intersectional identities.
Absolutely. So in my research, I really study exclusion. I study organizational exclusion. I like to think that I study inclusion, but at the end of the day, when I look at the, and I, before coming to this podcast, I looked at the body of work that I've been doing, and it's really focused on exclusion, mostly exclusion of women in sport organizations. I've studied the exclusion of women in men's college basketball, the experiences of these few women who actually have the opportunity to coach in men's college basketball, the exclusion and mistreatment of women with multiple marginalized identities. And from that work, I really brought in sort of the scope and interest of intersectionality as a framework, gender differences and perceptions of leadership, exclusion of international students in college athletics, sexism in professional sports. It's interesting because when I do look at the body of my work, it's a lot of negative stuff, right? It's a prescription for feeling kind of bad about college athletics, professional athletics, but more specifically women in sports. But I don't see it that way because I feel like the more that these stories are told, the more we're able to understand these cultures of exclusion and undo, redo, and create cultures that are more inclusive specifically to women.
Mm-hmm. I get that question a lot, and as I'm sure you do, looking at your body of work, is how do you get out of bed in the morning? this is really depressing data. We talk about letting the data tell the story, and it tells a story of exclusion. And I love how you're framing that. I'm not sure I've heard anyone frame it like that before, as we talk a lot about D&I and E, right? But it's really about exclusionary practices in the system, so we can get to a more inclusionary system, but we're certainly not there yet.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to understand what's happening in organizations, you have to understand where the organization has been. So to understand what's happening with women in professional sports, and college sports in general in sports, you really have to understand where women have been, how they've been treated, what's the history of women inclusion, and what we find is a lot of exclusion. So again, although it seems very negative, I think it's important that we face these realities.
Yeah, and it's important that we leverage our passion and our expertise to create change, because if we don't do it, who's going to do it, right? So somebody has to do the work. And I always think, how far behind or even more exclusionary would we be if we don't do the work?
Absolutely. And, you know, the work that we're talking about, this idea of undoing culture, we're very comfortable with it when it comes to other parts of organizations, sport or otherwise. We're very comfortable with undoing a culture that doesn't lead to profits. We're very comfortable with undoing a culture that doesn't, that's not competitive. But when it comes to undoing a culture that's unfair to women, we're a little resistant, right? And I think that shouldn't be the case.
So true. Tell me, what are you working on right now that you're really excited about? What's in the hopper? What are you cooking up?
I am super excited about a book that I'm working on. So an economist named David Barry, who does a lot of work with women's sports in general, gender pay, you know, gender wage gap. He and I are working on a book where we're basically challenging the trolls. So if you're on social media and you follow women's sports, you follow women athletes, you follow women who are doing research in this area, or even men like Dave Barry, who's doing research in this area, then you have a good understanding that there are a lot of trolls who want to spread myths about women's sports. And essentially what we do in our book is we debunk these myths. We go through and systematically debunk myths related to women not being tough enough, which is very easy. Look at Serena Williams, right? I mean, to be able to win the Australian Open 8 weeks pregnant, you're kind of tough if you can do that. The myths around women's sports not being as valuable as men's sports, again, we go through and we use data and storytelling to debunk that one as well. So, you know, it's a fun book to write because we have some really cool stories, historical as well as anecdotes from some of the things that's happening right now in contemporary times, but we also have data, and we're sharing the data in a way that, you know, I'm not completely comfortable with this being my first book, but certainly Dave is very comfortable in sharing the data through storytelling so that it's very relatable for people.
Do you have a working title that you can release here first on Tucker Center Talks?
We have a working title. You know, it has to go through the process of the publishers and all of that good stuff. So it might change, but Women Do Sports Stupid is the name of the book. And it's Women Do Sports, Stupid, right? So it's a little provocative, but at the end of the day, we feel comfortable calling out trolls. Again, their reasoning for why they attack women's sports is not based on reality. It's not consistent with reality at all. So again, we have the data to support it. We have the storytelling, and we feel very confident in being provocative with the title.
I cannot, for one, wait to read this book because I love this concept of using data to refute damaging narratives, false stories, and just, as you like to say, trolls, and, you know, slap them down, clap them back. You know, they need, and, you know, they probably won't read the book, which is problematic because they're precisely the ones who should, but they don't care about women's sport. They just want to be nasty and perpetuate these myths. And so for those of us that do like data, this is going to be really helpful so we can all have a consistent storytelling narrative that says, hey, guess what? people love women's sport. Women are tough. Women's sport is economically viable, and really use that data to lift up women's sport with facts. And if you want to follow Dr. Walker and Dr. Barry on Twitter, they are great follows. So I will say Dr. Walker's Twitter handle is Neff Walker, and Dave Barry's is Wages of Win. And they're two of my most active people on my Twitter feed. And I'm always looking forward to what you two are posting, because it's cutting edge, it's relevant, and it's insightful.
Thank you for that. And we can't wait to begin to post on the book. Like I said, the stories and the data, I'm sure we're going to get inundated with trolls who are telling us that the data isn't true. And what about your methods, and having all these questions, trying to interrogate the stories that we're telling and the data that we're providing, but we're ready for it.
Yeah, it reminds me of a time I was at the Women Coaches Academy in Denver, and after a long day of sessions, all of us and all these women coaches were down in the bar, and we're having a drink, and they had the WNBA on one screen and the baseball playoffs on the other screen, or wait, the start of the baseball season on one screen and the WNBA playoffs on the other. And, you know, we were watching sort of both, and there was a guy right behind me, and he was talking about men's college sport and how football makes all this money and why are they showing women's basketball on TV? And I just thought, okay, let the poor guy, just let him spout off. And I couldn't. So I turned around nicely and I said, actually, men's football and most Division I programs loses money and is not profitable. Well, you're not correct. And he started arguing with me. And I just said, you know what? Look it up.
Yeah. Look it up.
And the women around me, their eyes were really big. And the one turned to me and she said, you should have told them what you do for a living. I go, you know what? It doesn't matter. I wasn't going to win the argument, but at least I tried.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, as Dave and I, as we write this book, we're thinking of this in some ways as a toolkit for women and allies, right? It's, you know, you don't have to necessarily be a woman, but certainly we're speaking to women and our allies in creating this toolkit where people can use the data. They can use these stories that we have to prove their points that women's sports are worthy.
So when is this coming out? When can we anticipate its release and a book signing, hopefully live?
Yeah, we hope fall 21, but we're still, like I said, in the process of having our agent work through publishing houses and all of that good stuff. So we need someone to buy it first. So as soon as someone buys the book, then we'll have a more confident timeline as far as the launch and release.
Okay, so anyone listening that loves this idea, that wants to buy the book, jump in, because this needs to be published, and the faster the better. It's going to have a lot of good data in it. So Dr. Walker, out of all the work that you're doing right now, what are you finding are sort of some of the sticky ideas that are resonating with people?
I think the biggest one is equality isn't sufficient for equity. And that's one that I've been spending a lot of time as of late speaking to people about. There's this notion that, you know, if we're trying to reach equality, which equality is to me, isn't sort of the end all be all. But if we're trying to reach equality, then there are certain things that we can do that should serve all people. And we know that's just not the case. We know that, you know, for instance, people with disabilities, whether it be social anxiety disorder or others, the things that we're doing for women aren't going to serve them necessarily. It might serve some women who have, you know, both intersecting identities, but even those women, we know it might not serve. The work of Kimberly Crenshaw for the last 30 years has proven that serving the needs of Black folks and serving the needs of women doesn't necessarily serve the needs of Black women, that these intersecting identities that we have create very unique experiences and very unique needs. So I think, you know, one sticking point is really trying to move people beyond an idea of equality and moving them towards equity, which really takes into consideration the unique individual aspects of needs. And that's one that I spend a lot of time in, what I call my, I don't know if it's my, it's my day job. My chancellor would say is my day job. So in my day job, I spend a lot of time thinking about that, right? Not only am I my moonlight job now, which is researching and being a professor and faculty member, but in my day job as chief diversity officer, that's where I spend a lot of energy. When we're creating policies around diversity, equity, and inclusion, ensuring that we're meeting the unique needs of the individuals. We're not creating blanket policies and hoping that they will serve everyone.
Right. Can you provide a concrete example of a policy or strategy that you have implemented recently that would speak to equity?
Oh gosh, that I've implemented recently. I can share another one that might resonate with more people, working from home. So, you know, at the beginning of the pandemic, it was this idea that the best way to reach the needs of everyone is to create more flexible remote work opportunities. And that's what we did. That's what everyone did. We said, okay, here's some, materials for you. Here's some equipment for you. You can now go work from home. You have Zoom, you have your laptops, you should be good to go. And we know that wasn't the case for a lot of people. Not only did they have differing home experiences that didn't allow for that, but you know, some people quite literally cannot do their job at home. So those folks had to continue to go in and sacrifice their health with very little accommodations and very little consideration for their experiences while everyone else, you know, seemingly was fine working from home. So I think when we think about, you know, that's a specific one that I think many people can relate to, but there are many more times where we're creating blanket policies that really only serve the needs of the folks that have power and privilege.
Yeah, I think this concept of equity versus equality, so many people, maybe not those tuning into this podcast, but our students, our families, our community members really just do not understand the difference between the two. In fact, this morning on National Public Radio, they had a show on body positivity, and it was featuring the work of Aubrey Gorman, and who's wrote a book on fat shaming. And she was talking about equity in our health system for fat people or over fat or obese. So she had many different terminologies for it. And I thought, man, I have never really thought about obesity in terms of health equity in that specific way before. It's really insightful. I'll put that link to the show notes at the end of this.
Yeah, and I think
make a note of that.
And I think, you know, when I think about the research that young scholars in particular are considering, the research on the margins is where the gaps are, right? It's not necessarily the stuff that everyone else is looking into and everyone else is spending their time and energy on, or the research that we see in the mainstream or top journals. It's really the research on the margins that will meet the needs as far as equity is concerned.
So do you have another sticky idea that's resonating with people in terms of your work and outreach?
I think what makes people really uncomfortable with my work, whether it's in sport or, you know, looking at sport organizations or looking at ways to improve the circumstances of women in sports, is the realization that we're going to have to undo stuff, right? So I teach a class called both in sport as well as our MBA program. It's a leadership and organizational behavior course for graduate students, so mostly MBA students. And they get it when we talk about other topics. They understand the signs of a toxic culture. They understand the signs of a failing culture. And they understand the steps of changing that, right? Like we go through this Cotter's 8 steps process. It's very clear. But when it comes to changing a culture that's not supportive of women, or people of color, or people with various disabilities, people get very uncomfortable with undoing things, right? It's like, oh, well, it's serving this big chunk of people, but that's not sufficient, right? We're creating organizations for all. And if we really are standing true to that, and if we really believe in inclusion in the ways that certainly we've been saying since last summer, then we have to get comfortable with undoing cultures. I'm not saying you have to completely undo everything that you do as an organization, but if your pool of candidates continue to be mostly white men, then you have to undo the ways that you're seeking these pool of candidates. You have to undo your recruitment. You have to undo parts of your website that you know candidates are frequenting so that you can attract the people that you're saying you want to be a part of your organization. And people get uncomfortable with that. It's a lot of work. It says, in some ways, it says something about your organization that you don't want to be true. But I think the harsh realities are the things that we have to face and tackle first if we're really going to get to a place of inclusion.
Yes. And I think any leader, well, not any, but leaders that take this seriously have really done a lot of reflecting and looking at strategies and policies and media content and who's in and who's out and how to make changes in a real way. It's not just about making performative allyship statements of "we're with you" or hashtagging things. It's about doing the work, doing, showing up, making changes strategically and acting. Words are not enough.
So, and I have an example of this. So last summer, actually it was last spring, right before, the pandemic really took hold of the country and, you know, the majority of people, at least in white collar type positions, began to work from home. I was in conversations with the NBA and doing some work with them around trying to increase the number of women in leadership positions. And since then, you know, the world has completely changed and the priorities have changed and there's other things that have happened. So we haven't moved further along on this project. But to me, they were an organization that was willing to undo certain aspects of their recruitment process. They're serious about increasing the number of women in leadership positions, both on the coaching side, the officiating part of their game, as well as in the front office. And what they were doing, actively doing, is they were trying to understand, where are the women that are 18, 19, and 20 years old that want to work in the NBA? Where are they now? And what can we do to create space for them to learn the systems of basketball, generally speaking, in hopes that both they'll move, you know, up the ranks to the WNBA, but also be willing to work in the NBA. And to me, that was fascinating because they were willing to change where they were recruiting people at that young of an age to increase the pipeline years down the line. And that's what organizations have to do if you're serious about it. You really have to understand where you're getting your pool of candidates from, and you have to begin to undo those norms and ways of thinking so that you can get a different pool of candidates.
Yeah. And I will look forward to see what the NBA does. I mean, I think out of all the pro leagues, they're sort of leading the way as an exemplar league. And I love what you said in the Fall Distinguished Lecture series about the WNBA, when you talked about their work of activism and social justice, and the women have been doing the work for years and now they're sort of in the spotlight, but they've been doing it all along. And so has the league. And you ended your talk with saying, be the WNBA.
Yeah. Be women, right? I mean, again, if we think about I believe it's Shirley Chisholm who has a quote that says something along the lines of, I'm probably going to butcher it, that from birth, women are stereotyped, right? And this is the idea that very early on, women have to deal with oppression. And whether we recognize it or call it that or not, women have to deal with it. People of color have to deal with it. Those that have other marginalized identities have to deal with oppression. So if you're looking for someone who is good at this, then it's probably the folks who have been managing it and navigating it for most of their existence. Mm-hmm.
So true. So for the young women, scholars, wannabe scholars, those in the pipeline, we're trying to grow them up and get them into the pipeline, as we've just been talking about. What advice do you give young women scholars?
The advice that I give them is similar to, I don't know if anyone gave me this advice. I think they just supported the work that I wanted to do, but find the gaps. I think a lot of doc students come in and when they begin their, or graduate students in general, when they begin the process of knowing they want to be a faculty member, researcher, professor, they very quickly identify gaps. And I think it's those established researchers who try to push them towards either their research interests or what they see being published. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think the movement, the stretching of whether it's theory or practice is really in the gaps, and where these young scholars can really service is by putting their attention and energy and passions towards that gap. Mm-hmm. I can take myself as an example. When I started my PhD program, like 13 years ago now, I knew what I wanted to study. I wanted to study women coaching and men's basketball. My reasoning for that was because I grew up playing pickup basketball with guys all the time. And I just could not believe that no women wanted to coach in men's basketball. I knew women who weren't getting opportunities in women's basketball because, you know, whatever reasons there weren't enough jobs. They didn't want to leave the South, whatever the reason might be, they weren't getting those opportunities in women's basketball, but they were passionate about basketball. And my question was always, okay, well, try men's basketball, right? Try coaching AAU, boys and girls, right? Like, why not? Of course, we want more women and women's sports. Absolutely. But if women are having a hard time getting their foot in the door, why not try their, you know, try
double to your opportunity.
Why not? Yeah. Right. And even if women don't want to, they should have the opportunity and they should have access. But I remember when I started researching this area, people were just like, nah, who cares? No one cares about this. No one's researching it. No one's looked at it since Lovett and Lowry back in 1994. What are you doing? There's no literature on it because it's just not a concern right now. What's really a concern are these things. And I was a bit resistant and stubborn because I'm like, well, no, I'm playing with guys every day. Like, there is something here. And I can remember my advisor, Dr. Michael Sagas, he's the one who was just like, no, do it. If you want to do it, do it. Who cares? You'll be fine. And he encouraged me, as well as the people in my cohort that I went through my doc program. They were my biggest cheerleaders, you know, my hype women, men behind me, just really saying, this is pretty cool. No one's doing it. I don't know where it's going to take you, but why not? And then you look, you know, 13 years later, and that's one of the hottest topics in sports right now is the amount of women as officials, as coaches, as executives in men's sports. So I think you should follow your passion. You're going to be much happier researching, spending all the hours and hundreds of pages that you have to read, doing something and reading about something that you're passionate about.
That is such good advice. And I love that story of your doctoral work. And back then, nobody was talking about it but you. There was no Becky Hammon with the Spurs. And now look, now she was the first, or, you know, one of the first, not the first, but now mm-hmm. we have what, 11, maybe more now of women assistant coaches in the NBA. And your work paved the way for understanding that. And so, yeah, follow your passion. And so what if nobody's doing it? That's the gap. Fill it.
That's the gap, right? And again, you have very few moments in life when you can truly put all of your energy mm-hmm. towards your passion. And being a doc student is that one of those moments where you can put all of your energy and efforts towards your passion. So take advantage of it, because once you become a faculty member, there are all sorts of distractions.
Yes, as we navigate them daily. And I think for the faculty listening, let's not turn out mini-me's. Let's let our doctoral students be creative and push the edge and fill the gap and do the work on the margin that perhaps we don't even aren't experts in or know nothing about. That's exciting. That's one of the things I love most about my job with the young people I get to work with, is they're constantly saying, what about this, Dr. Lavoie? I'm like, I don't even know what that is. So please enlighten me. And then we learn together.
Yeah, same. Exactly. I learned so much from working with my doc students. Lauren Hyman, who is my current doc candidate, who just accepted a position to work as an assistant professor tenure track at Stonehill College in the business school. She pushed me just recently. She pushed me to the margins with a revise and resubmit manuscript where I had to learn a whole new discourse analysis methodology, right? And I'm like, Lauren, it's fall. We're in the middle of a pandemic. I don't have time for this, but I made time. She made me make time. And now I've expanded sort of my capabilities when it comes to data analysis.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's fun. That's one of the benefits of our job is we constantly get to learn too. Okay. I'm going to wrap this up. We're going to have a section two on this podcast because there's so many things to talk to you about. All right. Here's our speed round. Okay. Uh-oh. These are kind of softballs, but we'll see where you land. Okay. Who is your favorite badass woman right now?
Oh, that's easy. Vice President Kamala Harris. I mean, yeah, that's an easy one for me right now. I mean, she's arguably the most powerful woman in the world, right? And Absolutely. She did it her own way. She did it wearing Chucks and a blazer, which is, you know, certainly right up my alley. So...
Yeah. Did I see something recently where you can't even find Chucks anywhere right now?
They're wow. Really? Out. That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. Your favorite book right now?
I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's what I'm reading right now. It's called The Production of Difference. I'll have to send you the author's names or put it in the notes for this podcast. Mm-hmm. But essentially what this book is taking you through the history of creating differences based on race. So the history of racism in management and labor. And I'm reading this book so that I have a better understanding of how to sort of navigate the writings that I'm doing related to race and management and in business.
Mm. Okay, I'm adding that to my list, my reading list. Okay, next, who's one influential female scholar in your world?
One influential, can I give you two?
Sure, you can double
okay.
tap.
Okay, good. They're going to be my colleagues, Dr. Nicole Melton and Dr. Janet Fink. Both challenge me, push me, cheer me on in very different ways. And I'm so appreciative of both of them because they've helped create the scholar that I am today. Nicole, we do a lot of work together. Mm-hmm. We publish together. You know, we have similar research interests, although we tackle it from very different angles. So she's someone that I can always go to bounce ideas off of. But also she's probably my biggest hype woman. She's constantly telling me I can do it when I'm, you know, telling her I think I'm done, I can't do anymore. She's like, oh, I think you can stretch yourself, say no to this, but do that. And then Dr. Janet Fink, of course, you know, of research course. Ideas, theoretical frameworks, but also just, you know, navigating administration. Mm-hmm. Both Dr. Janet Fink and Dr. Carol Barr have helped me enormously with the big decisions I've had to make around, do I accept these positions in administration like associate dean or vice chancellor? And they've given me very good advice and often pushed me towards saying yes as well.
Well, I have to say that on the first episode of season 3, Dr. Laura Burton also named Dr. Fink. So I think maybe I've got my next guest.
We
got to bring
so.
Janet Fink on Tucker Center Talks and speak to her directly.
And
all
I
right,
think...
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say, I think it's because Janet is just so giving and she's brutally honest. So she's a person that you can go to and whether you like it or not, she's going to tell you exactly how she's feeling and she's going to be very thoughtful in her approach to supporting you. And I think those are things that most people can appreciate and most people need.
Yeah, we all need the truth teller in our life. Like, just give it to me. Don't sugarcoat it. Tell it to me like it is. All right, last speed round question. Who is your favorite Peloton instructor?
Oh, Tundi for sure. Okay. And Jess Sims. Both of them. And it's because they're just so hard. I work out often with two colleagues. One's not here, Kwame Ajumong, who's at the Ohio Ohio State University as a faculty member in sport management. And then Elena McCauley, who's here at UMass with me. And, you know, they both just beat us up. Which you kind of enjoy, right? You want a coach. I feel like they're my coach. Yeah. So when I complain, and they're telling me to keep going, I'm like, okay, well, they're speaking to me right now because I kind of want to quit.
Yes. Yeah. There's some brutal rides on the Peloton. My Peloton's back in Minnesota as I'm down in the Arizona for the winter. I get to actually ride my bike outside, but it's now snowing and raining here in Prescott, Arizona, and I'm missing the Peloton. And so I'm living vicariously through the Peloton groupies. Well, so thank you, Dr. Walker, for joining Tucker Center Talks today. Any last parting thoughts?
My last parting thoughts would be probably in the words of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, women belong where decisions are being made. And that's sort of my motto for the book that we're writing and for the way that I live my life, I hope, as an administrator, as well as a researcher.
That's a great way to wrap things up. So thank you for joining Tucker Center Talks. For the listeners out there, be sure to check out our many free evidence-based resources on our website at tuckercenter.org. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Our website includes a video archive of all our distinguished lecture series videos, which we talked about earlier, which features the best and the brightest scholars that discuss issues related to girls and women in sport. You can find the show notes with links and resources for this episode at wispsports.com. Look for the Tucker Center Talks under the Listen tab, where you'll find more conversations from the world of women's sport. Thank you for listening and helping us turn up the volume on women's sport. That's a wrap for Tucker Center Talks. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Lavoie, signing off to make a difference in the lives of girls and women in sport. Stay safe, give yourself grace, support others, and let the data tell the story.